Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point. Shane Holland was just swimming at his apartment complex pool when the manager approached him and told him to get out.
But listen, hold up. First of all, the question that you asked me was, do I live here? I said yes. Then you asked me what my address was. I showed you my key. What more of a conversation needs to be held?
Days before, in North Carolina, a similar situation. A woman at the pool in her subdivision was questioned, but this time, someone called the cops.
I'm the only black person here with my son in the pool, and he walked only to me to ask for my ID.
3 months ago, a video went viral of police arresting two black men who were just sitting at a Starbucks waiting for a friend. 3 months later, it feels like there's a new story like this just about every week. Black people doing normal things, selling newspapers, napping in a dorm lounge, playing golf, checking into an Airbnb, and someone calls the cops. And then the video goes viral. This hour on Point, Living While Black, summer 2018. You can join us on air or online. What do you make of these stories? If you've seen these videos, are you sharing them on social media? And joining me now from Detroit, Michigan, is Rochelle Riley. She's a columnist with the Detroit Free Press. She recently wrote a column entitled, Should People Be Charged for Calling the Police Because of Race? You can find it on our website at onpointradio.org. And Rochelle Riley, welcome to On Point. It's great to have you.
Thank you so much.
I'd like to just read just the first three lines of your story. It begins like this. A retired Michigan firefighter fires a 12-gauge shotgun at a 14-year-old who got lost on his way to school. A manager at a Pennsylvania Starbucks calls the police on two black men whose crime is sitting and waiting for a friend. An L.A. fitness manager in New Jersey calls the police after falsely accusing a gym member of not paying to work out. Now, a white parent on a Colorado college tour called campus police because two Native American teenagers made her nervous. So that's the way your piece begins. Tell me what that story about those two teenagers who were touring the Colorado campus, what struck you in particular about that story? All these stories, for that matter, but focus on that one.
Well, they're all pretty bad, but in this case, these were two young men who were looking to possibly attend this college. These are educated, hardworking brothers who drove 7 hours to take this tour, which they had signed up for and were registered for. But because they arrived a little late and because they looked somehow suspicious to one of the other parents on the tour, she notified the police. And rather than them arriving and checking everyone's ID and making sure the tour was okay, they pulled them out of the tour to question them about where they were from, why they were there, double checking, you know, to make sure they were registered. And of course, by that time, the tour had continued without them. And I thought about what they must have felt like on that 7-hour drive back home. And it broke my heart.
You know, one is tempted to respond to all these stories by asking, is this new? But I think we know that it's not new. What is new is that we're seeing it so much more because of all of these videos that are going viral. First of all, do you agree with that? And second of all, what should we be taking away from these stories?
Well, for anyone who has been really frustrated by the proliferation of cell phones and the fact that people can't seem to keep their noses out of, you know, their hands and we're not really talking to each other, the upside is that we really are having an opportunity to reveal just how much dissension and how much hatefulness and how many times there are these types of acts that are going on. They have been happening, and they're not new. What's new is the revelation of them. What's new is that people are actually seeing them. So for folks who would say, and I talk to some folks like that every week, racism is not as bad as it used to be, and we shouldn't talk about it so it will go away. It's as bad as ever, and if we don't start talking about it and dealing with it, it's only going to get worse because people are feeling empowered to act on their hatefulness in a way that this country hasn't seen for a long time.
And what do you think explains that, Rochelle Riley? I mean, why now? Why are people feeling this, in your view, to sort of act on their hatefulness that they haven't felt in a long time?
Well, you know, people will, you know, say this devolves back into the same political discussion, but it's not a discussion about politics, and it's not about Donald Trump as president or another, you know, dissertation on how he won the election. Donald Trump won the election. Donald Trump is the president. Let's move those two things out of the way. This is not about that. This is about how our current president acts. This is about how if you have someone who is, or at least until recently, was leader of the free world, making it okay to say the types of things that he says, to challenge people in the way that he does. People who hear that think, oh, it's finally okay for me to say what I feel and to do what I want. And he's not alone, but the more that rises, the more that he empowers other people, all of a sudden we've got lots of people who are feeling like, I don't have to put a hood on to be racist. I don't have to be worried about speaking out, about not wanting somebody in my neighborhood. It's okay for me to hit a 90-something-year-old man with a brick because I want him to go back to Mexico. I can question that woman because she's in our pool and she's the only black person and she may not be in the right place. We can't have a situation, we can't have a country, we can't have a space in our history where these things are made to feel like they're okay. We have to have a zero-tolerance policy on this type of behavior.
And I want to talk to you as this hour goes on about how we get there. We're speaking with Rochelle Riley. She's a columnist of the Detroit Free Press. And we're talking about all these episodes that we're seeing on the internet, on these viral videos of black people having folks call the cops on black people who are doing seemingly normal things. So here's an example. This viral video from last month shows a San Francisco woman calling the police to report an 8-year-old black girl selling water on the sidewalk without a permit. The woman who became known on the internet is Permit Patty. Let's listen to this.
This woman don't want to let a little girl sell some water. She calling the police on an 8-year-old little girl. You can hide all you want. The whole world gonna see you, boo.
Yeah, and illegally selling water without a permit?
Yeah. On my property.
It's not your property.
That video went viral last month. Rochelle Riley, in your piece, one of the things that you get to is you say this poses a bigger problem for police. Can you talk about that?
Absolutely. And I spoke with our police chief here in Detroit about it. Every time you call a police officer for something silly, like the little boy next door accidentally cutting some of your lawn while he cut his, or because someone is swimming in a pool and you don't think they should be there, or because someone is sleeping in their common room, in their dormitory at Yale. Anytime you are calling them away from that, that takes them away from whatever else they should be doing, which is their actual duty. And it can get to the point, if we don't nip this in the bud, where it's really going to cause some problems, where somebody is going to be hurt or somebody's going to need an officer, and they're not there because they're chasing something frivolous by people calling, you know, the police on black people for breathing while black.
Yeah, interesting. I mean, we've been talking, we've talked a lot in the past, of course, about police violence against black people, in many cases unarmed black people, that appeared, at least initially, and often was unjustified. This isn't what we're talking about here. Here we're talking about cops, folks who dial 911, and I guess police don't really have a choice here about whether to respond, right?
Actually, I don't know that that's true. When I talked with the chief, he said that every dispatcher and every officer has the ability, based on what they're told, to know whether someone's in danger or not, to know how to handle a situation. You don't have to roll 6 police officers to someone who is calling because somebody has presented a coupon that they think is fake at a drugstore. That's not something that requires SWAT. So I think that they have to start being discerning. He said he's been talking with his officers about that. And if I called in and said, you know, I'm concerned about someone who's walking the streets in my neighborhood who looks like they're casing the place. Okay, well, if you've got a patrol officer, you know, stay in the house, lock the door, we'll send somebody just to see. But if you're calling somebody because somebody is standing in their yard getting their newspaper, but they're black and you didn't know black people had moved in, That's not something that you have to literally roll with the lights flashing.
Yeah. Well, let me introduce Steve Brown. He's a research associate at the Urban Institute and a doctoral candidate at Harvard University for Sociology. He has studied racial and socioeconomic inequality in the United States. And Stephen Brown, thanks for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, I'd like to sort of get your initial reaction to what's going on here. What is going on here? How do you process it?
I think what we're seeing today with hashtag Living While Black, with the police being called on people going just about their daily lives, stems from a long history of discrimination and residential segregation. Going back to Jim Crow and redlining, I think we have long put restraints, both formal and informal, on where people could go and what activities they can engage in. And I think what we're seeing today are what I would call the social side effects of segregation, though I think the socioeconomic effects of segregation are well known and they're numerous and profound. Segregation also separates us socially in all kinds of in ways, all big and small. I think it's a structure that places some people in one place and other people in another. And I think what we're seeing here is actually less about criminal justice and more about a sense of entitlement over physical space and who can be where. And so I think with these events where you have people calling the police, I think it is, you know, stemming from just this long history that we have of people being separated in physical space and just trying to continue to enforce a certain set of social order.
Yeah.
That
so, Stephen, we're going to get to solutions. But I mean, as troubling as these videos are, do you see the sort of social activism part of this story as a positive thing? In that people, maybe for the first time, a lot of people are getting a glimpse of what's really happening out there and obviously has been happening for a while.
I think that's right. I think it's really great that we're seeing all these social media videos and people posting things about what's happening out when people are interacting and having the police called on them. And so I think it's a really good thing that people are starting to be exposed to just how prevalent this all is.
All right. I want to ask Stephen Brown and Rochelle Riley to stand by. We're talking about the recent slew of viral videos of white people calling the cops on black people in most cases who are doing pretty much everyday things. You can join the conversation. Has this happened to you? What explains it? Is this about social segregation, as Stephen Brown suggests? How can we change things so that it stops? We'll be back in a moment. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLS consumeraccess.org, number 3030.
There's a new way to hear Morning Edition, All Things Considered, and all your favorite programs. Just ask your smart device to play NPR. Listen to your local station anytime, like this. Hey, smart device, play NPR.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. We're talking about hashtag Living While Black this summer and the spate of recent stories and viral videos of white Americans calling the cops on black Americans doing normal things, from swimming in a community pool to shopping to taking a nap. You can join the conversation. What is going on here? What motivates someone to dial 911 in this kind of non-emergency? Is it hate, prejudice? So let's hear a little bit of tape from out there about this situation. So a white woman who became known as Barbecue Becky on the internet called the police on two black men who were barbecuing in a public park in Oakland, California this past April. It sparked an event called Barbecuing While Black. In that same park the next month, here's part of the viral exchange the woman had with a passerby.
Are you sure it's not because you don't want black people being out here?
It has nothing to do with their race.
It seems like a new Jim Crow going on, because for some reason, every time I see it, black people are the ones targeted regarding barbecuing at the lake. And you're a perfect example of it right now.
And here's another example. A gentleman named Darren Martin, who, by the way, had been a staffer in the Obama White House, was moving into his new Manhattan apartment in April when someone called the police on him, reporting an attempted burglary. Martin quickly began to Facebook Live the situation. Here's his exchange with the police.
What's the problem? I live here.
What
are you guys investigating?
Listen. They call, right? So we're doing our job. That's it.
Who called you?
If you do nothing wrong, you're good to go.
Who called you?
Someone called us.
Okay, so we're talking with Rochelle Riley from the Detroit Free Press, Stephen Brown from the Urban Institute. Rochelle, in your piece, you propose one idea, and that is people who make these non-emergency calls to 911 that turn into what can only be called harassment, you say they should be punished.
Well, it's not non-emergency calls. It's quite frankly frivolous calls.
Yeah.
If you're calling because someone you don't know is barbecuing, or if you're calling because you think someone may have stolen deli meat from a store when there's no evidence of it and you aren't someone who saw them do anything, and then you have a police officer who comes and searches a woman's entire shopping bag and purse and questions her, the woman was a vegan. So I think that, you know, there's a difference in being genuinely concerned about something, which every person has the right to do, and doing something that's quite frivolous and hate-filled. I think that, you know, there are several jurisdictions across the country that have charges on the books for filing a false police report. So people should just take great care in deciding that they want to raise something to the level of calling a police department. If you see an 8-year-old child selling water and it bothers you that much, take a picture, take it to City Hall, and tell them she's doing this without a permit. But you do not call an emergency officer who might need to be stopping a robbery somewhere.
Yeah. Stephen Brown, I know you're talking about much sort of more complex problems around segregation and the way our society is set up. But respond to Rochelle Riley's idea. Do you think that would at least move this in the right direction?
I think she's exactly right that these calls to police are a problem. I'm not sure if I agree that we should be punishing the people that are calling 911. Trying to weigh this against the fact that most of the people who interact with the police are black and brown and minority. And I think if we start to implement a set of rules or fines that penalize people for calling the police, I think people of color would end up bearing the brunt of that responsibility. But I do think there are other efforts that we can take to discourage these kind of calls. We can train 911 dispatchers to to inquire about whether this is an emergency or not. When someone calls 911 and says, you know, there are people in this park and they're barbecuing without a permit, or they shouldn't have the charcoal grill over here, I think a 911 dispatcher can say, well, is there an emergency? Is there a fire? Is there an active crime taking place? If not, then no, we're not going to dispatch the police. So I think there are other efforts where we can, where 911 dispatchers and police officers can just exercise more discretion and whether or not they even take the call.
I'd love to get some callers into this conversation. So let's go to Jay, who's calling from Miami, Florida. Jay, thanks so much for calling. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, Anthony.
Hey there.
Big fan, by the way.
Appreciate that.
I have countless instances of things that happened to me by regular, ordinary people and by police officers just for walking while black, driving while black. I'm sorry, it's a little hard, but one instance in particular, and out of the countless, was when I was going to the University of Miami and pulled up to the guard gate to drop off my girlfriend, who was fair-skinned, Argentinian, and Caucasian mix. And I had a police officer knock on my window with their weapon drawn and ask me to roll the window down and had the gun literally inches from my face and asked my girlfriend, "Ma'am, are you okay?" And neither of us got just the startling, you know, just seeing a gun in your face and At first, we didn't even know it was an officer. We were stuck at the guard gate. When she figured out that the officer was asking because, you know, about her condition, because she was white and I was black, she went off. And that's the state that we're in. It's insane. I've gotten police to pull me over. I'm sorry.
Jay, you know what? I so hear what you're saying. I hear the emotion in your voice, and I'm going to just really thank you for calling. And I want to turn to Rochelle Riley, because in her piece, and in your piece, Rochelle, you write that these events can cause deep injury to people. And I'm not saying necessarily that our caller is deeply injured, but my God, you can hear the emotion in this. And I'd love you to just talk a little bit about that.
I think people become too quick to want to dismiss these things. It's, oh, well, it worked out okay in the end, or, oh, well, someone didn't mean any harm. But there's great harm done. There's no way for us to know from a complete stranger the level of injury, but there's an obvious injury when you hear someone talk about having a gun drawn in their face because of who they're with and because of the assumptions that people make. To be in your own campus dormitory and fall asleep on a couch and have a police officer wake you up, these are not little things that just like, oh, okay, no big deal, let me just go on with my life. We shouldn't have to, because it's a part of our lives. It's a part of the lives of so many people. And at some point, we have to figure out, besides shaming people, because we should say that the other punishment, and I understand the other guest's concern about trying to be too punitive. I haven't heard yet of an instance where somebody black has called the police because someone was doing anything while white. But I do understand his point about trying to find too punitive a way to fix this. But I can tell you, the shaming has helped. All of these people that we've mentioned, from Coupon Carl to Permit Patty, suffered because of their circumstance. Is that the only way to stop? And will that be a deterrent, the way that Donald Trump wants taking people's children from them at the border to be a deterrent?
So here's another incident in this long list of incidents that we've been referring to. A man called the police during a pickup basketball game at a gym in Sterling, Virginia, this past Monday after he was knocked off the floor by a hard pick. Here are a couple of the players talking to the officers who arrived.
Have you ever been called for a basketball foul before?
No.
This is the first time?
That's my first basketball foul.
You were coming for a basketball foul?
Not for that, no. I just heard it was a fight.
Oh, okay.
But I'm like, all right.
Man, they called you for a foul, man.
So that was one of the players saying to the officer, they called you for a foul, and the officer saying, no, I heard there was a fight. But the officers were called because there was a couple of people bumped into each other on the basketball court. I want to invite another voice into this conversation. Paul Butler is a professor of law at Georgetown University. He's also author of Chokehold, Policing Black Men. Paul Butler, thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, Anthony. It's great to be here.
I know you've been listening along to this, so let me just ask you to give me your reaction to what you've been listening to and what you've been observing about this issue over the recent weeks and months.
You know, a lot of people are anxious or even afraid around black folks, especially African-American men. And sometimes people try to justify this by saying, well, black men commit more crime. But crime is actually a segregated transaction. Most white people are victimized by other white people, not by black men. These stereotypes still persist. The good news is we don't have to end racism to make things better. So I'm a tall black dude. If people, when they see me walking down the street, want to check to make sure their car doors are locked or they want to pull their purses closer, they have the right to do that. It doesn't mean it's cool. As the caller dramatically indicated, it's aggravating. It drains your health. It requires a performance every time a black person navigates spaces with white people. So you conspicuously display your work ID, you wear your college T-shirt, you look down on the airport. But, Anthony, the main problem is really the government response. What the government does is send the police to participate in the 911 caller's racist fantasy. So this is racial harassment sponsored by the government and supported by tax dollars.
I'm interested, though, Paul, what do you think? Rochelle was talking about, you know, punitive action against people who make these frivolous calls. I mean, is that where a solution might begin as well? Because I'm still stuck, and help me out here. I want to be careful sort of how I phrase this, but I am worried about how here's where I get hung up. So I call 911 for whatever reason, and at the other end is a dispatcher. Doesn't the dispatcher sort of have to give the benefit of the doubt that this is a person who says he or she is in distress, we've got to respond? Because if they make the mistake the wrong way, there could be consequences on the other side. So I'm still having trouble about how you train a dispatcher to really get to the bottom of what's going on here.
Well, you ask her to have common sense. When you call 911 in New York, the first question the dispatcher asks you is, what is your emergency?
Mm-hmm.
So in these cases, the answers would have been two black men sitting in Starbucks, black girl selling water on the street, black man swimming, black women moving luggage out of Airbnb. That does not merit a response from someone with a gun and the power to arrest.
Right. And what do you think of Rochelle Riley's idea that folks who make these calls frivolously, I mean, one way to sort of change the climate here is to make them pay for it in some way?
You know, all of this operates out of a larger system of structural inequality and white supremacy. And what that means is whenever there's a criminal sanction, it always disproportionately burdens people of color, even when the law is designed to help us. So hate crime laws, black men are disproportionately charged with those kinds of crimes. It's gotten so bad that even mandatory seatbelt rules, which are life-saving, a lot of times black lawmakers don't support those because they know that black men and women will be targeted for driving while black. So, you know, I think when people call 911, they want an intervention from a trained professional. They really sometimes need someone who is equipped to deal with a family dispute or a neighborhood beef or mental health crisis, somebody suffering from addiction to alcohol or other drugs. So if we provide those kinds of resources, that might help de-weaponize 911.
Hmm. Let's go to Ron, who's calling from Saluda, South Carolina. Ron, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Anthony. I appreciate you taking my call. And over the last few months, I've listened to NPR almost exclusively. I'm going to start out by saying I recently retired from a southeastern Michigan, rather large metro police department.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a minority officer myself, and I served for 41 years. And I made it all the way from a basic patrol officer to a precinct captain. I ran a precinct in a metropolitan area.
Well, congratulations to you for that. But go ahead.
When this video came out, and it's obviously before I retired, the mayor came to my.
Now, Ron, wait before you go on. Which we've been talking about a lot of videos. Which one in particular?
The video about the water.
Gotcha.
The water.
Yep.
The young lady selling the water.
Right.
And the mayor directed me to do a 5-year paperwork search. The mayor's a smart guy. You know, he went, hey, is this going on here? Let's find out. And he knew I was retiring, so he handed it off to me. And the demographics of our community, or the community where I used to work, we were roughly 35% Caucasian, roughly 53% African American, and then the rest was other races. And I took the time to do a good job. It took me about 47 days to do it. And the overwhelming majority of I don't have the percent right in front of me, but it was well over 71% of the non-emergency calls that were made by minority callers on non-minority offenders.
Hmm.
And my larger point about this is that, you know, when something like this happens, in my experience, and again, you know, 41 years as a police officer, it just gets blown out of proportion. And what ends up happening is like what several of your panelists were saying, why don't the 911 operators do a better job of screening the calls? Well, that's not the function of a 911 operator. The 911 operator takes emergency call, gives it to a dispatcher, and then what that does is that takes patrol officers, resources, tax dollars, all these things away from things. I mean, let's face it, I agree with what your one panelist says. Police officers have way better things to do than running interference between two people that have a dispute over a young lady selling water or two young gentlemen that want to use a bathroom in a Starbucks, all these things. But
Ron, we're coming up against a break here, but I want to thank you for your call. You put a couple of really interesting issues on the table that we'll pick up after the break. Listeners, we're talking about what happens when police are called by white people on black Americans for seemingly trivial things. We just had a caller talking about a lot of these non-emergency calls are being made by minorities, on non-minority folks. You can join the conversation. What's the solution here? What's the way forward? We'll be back in a moment. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
Hey, it's Guy Raz here, host of the TED Radio Hour. And on our latest episode, we're exploring the causes and consequences of hatred, what makes it such a powerful force, and why some people feel its pull more deeply. Take a listen to the TED Radio Hour on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. This summer, there have been several viral videos of white people calling the police on black people who just seem to be doing normal things, living their lives. You can join the conversation. In 2018, why are we still struggling with this? I'm with Rochelle Riley, a columnist at the Detroit Free Press, Georgetown law professor Paul Butler, and Stephen Brown from the Urban Institute. And we're taking your calls as well. Rochelle Riley, I want to come back to you and just actually, I want to get you all to sort of comment what we heard before the break. Ron, a former police officer from Southeast Michigan, I think he said, where he did a study and found that the majority of non-emergency calls actually came from people in his district, from people of color. So does this suggest that this is a wider, an even wider problem? Not that racially motivated calls isn't a huge problem, but does this suggest an even wider problem? What do you think, Rochelle?
Well, I think that the scholars on the program are right, that these are all vestiges of a time when this country lived in segregation. And yep, there are people that still wish for it, and there are people who try to make it happen by either staying away from people or making it impossible for people to be around them. The idea that you don't want someone in a pool or you don't want a little girl selling water, it wasn't about the water. It was about not being comfortable with those people being in that space. I think that what we have to do is get to a point in this country where we decide that we don't want to live with the color line anymore. When W.E.B. Du Bois said that color would be the color line would be the problem of the 20th century, I'm sure he had no idea that it would be the problem of the 21st. And we have to do something before it's the problem of the 22nd.
Hmm. I think one of the challenges here, and Paul Butler, let me come to you with this, is when these things happen, for obvious reasons, they mean different things to different people. So I want to read a comment from our website from Brian4000, who writes, I have to be honest, most of these cases, except for a couple, don't look racially motivated. It seems like now anytime a white person calls the police on a black person, racism is simply assumed. This is not a recipe for a stable society. I think no one is taking time to evaluate each case before the social media mob ruins people's lives. Respond to that, Paul.
So learn some history, my friend. There's a whole history here. So in the antebellum South, when a white person made a false accusation against an African American, she was lynched. Black people weren't even allowed to offer testimony in court against white folks. And yes, we've come a ways since then, but if we look at how our criminal legal process works, it's still very focused on people of color and especially black men. So we have more black people in the criminal justice system now than there were slaves in 1850. And so a lot of this starts with that 911 call, which isn't colorblind. Again, often it's all about race. People say, well, what do you want the police to do? So if we look at some of these instances, the four black women who were moving luggage out of an Airbnb, the police are called. That doesn't happen to white folks, or at least white folks don't know about it because the police just roll by. I'm a former prosecutor. I know how much discretion police have. And so Darren, the young man who was moving into the apartment in New York City, again, the police showed up and they saw a young black man moving, but they still put you through the process. You're forced by armed officers of the government to justify your presence. What's your name? Show us some ID. What are you doing here? Do you have your lease? All of that doesn't happen to white people anywhere near the rate it happens to folks of color.
Mm. Stephen Brown, you talked earlier in the hour about a chief cause of this situation being social segregation, which is obviously so deeply ingrained in various levels of our society. What's the solution to begin to change that? Because we're really talking about changing things that have been, boy, just baked into the layers of our society.
That's a really good question, Anthony. I think what we have to begin to recognize is that this history of segregation has kind of pulled us apart in very significant ways that won't be overcome or corrected in a day or a year or maybe even 10 years or 50 years. I think what we have to do is try to think about how to move back in the right direction. So thinking about the social segregation, there was a poll that was done a few years ago that showed that most white people have only white friends. And most black people have friends of color, but they're more likely to have white friends. But even people's social circles are segregated. We're starting to see now that political orientation is starting to be there's more political polarization and people red states are getting redder. Red counties are getting redder. Blue states are getting bluer. Blue counties are getting bluer. And so people aren't seeing each other or interacting each other in the same way. I think there are probably some structural things that we can do and some individual things that we can do. So I think the structural things we can do that, you know, there have been efforts both federally and locally to try to break some of this up. There have been policies such as affirmatively furthering fair housing, which was a HUD policy that has since been suspended by Secretary Carson's HUD, but it was a policy that gave communities tools to begin to measure and then develop ways to break down the segregation in their cities and in their communities. There's also been efforts from the Obama White House to give communities tools to kind of break through local zoning regulations that continue to segment segregation, but also drive up housing prices that make it harder for people to live and move into diverse, high opportunity communities. So I think those are some structural things that we could revisit and try to address this problem. But I think individually, I think everyone has to take a bit more effort and onus to be cautious in how we interact with people, be cautious in how we consider when we consider calling the police, be friendly to your neighbors, just the general good neighborly things that people do. And I think it's certainly I think the onus is on people of the people who are in power,
Stephen Brown, to that point, I just want to read this comment from a listener on Twitter. Sarah Kaplan writes, yes, I share the videos of people having the police called on them for hashtag existing while black. But what is most important is that white women like me and my friends need to step in when we see it happen, not just record, but use our privilege to intervene. And that comment came to us on Twitter. And I want to go back to the phones. Let's go to Patrick, who's calling from Stanton, Virginia. Patrick, it's good to have you. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hello, Anthony and panel. One of the things that I wanted to address is a lot of these videos that are going viral are in urban areas where you have people that can actually see that. Myself, I'm a very obviously Hispanic male who works in agriculture. I do farm work. Twice over the winter, I've been pulled over for driving while brown. And, you know, it's exceptionally scary for me because I am out here in the middle of nowhere where I don't have anybody with a camera protecting me and body cameras that may or may not work. You know, I've got three kids, one of which is getting ready to drive. How do I tell them, yeah, you know, go ahead, trust these police after they just shook daddy down going to work, you know, and to be told that, oh, you know, these are rare occurrences and they happen in cities that are full of millions of people just doesn't wash with me. And it's not being addressed that it's also happening out here in the middle of the country, you know, out in the sticks with somebody just trying to make work. I'm a 15-year military veteran, disabled veteran, and I've got to slap all these stickers on my car so as not to get hassled by the police because I, as one of them told me, I fit the description of somebody who committed a crime three towns over.
Oh, boy. Patrick, I want to really thank you for your call, and I'm sorry you've been going through that, but thanks for the call. What you say really speaks volumes to the sort of challenge that we're discussing this hour. Let's go to Dory, who's calling from New Orleans, Louisiana. Dory, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yes. Hi, Anthony. I'm panel. Thanks for taking my call. I had a comment, I guess, about the first thing that was discussed on this segment about, you know, why is this seem to be happening? You know, why are we seeing an instance of white individuals calling the police on black or brown individuals? And I really think that it's a function in a way of an increase in sort of a culture of fear that it's being perpetuated, unfortunately, by our current political leadership. But, you know, people just in general are going to fear the stranger. You know, it's kind of a part of our nature. And, you know, effective de facto segregation around the country is that, you know, people are strangers, and so I'm afraid of them. Something that I see happening less here in New Orleans, because there tends to be a lot more different people around, and maybe in larger cities, that you don't see people calling, you know, for no apparent reason.
Right.
But it doesn't mean the segregation is gone either.
Dory, I'm going to jump in because the quality of your cell phone connection is breaking up a little bit, but we got your point. Paul Butler, I'd love you to sort of respond to a couple of those last calls. Going back to Patrick, the Latino caller calling from rural America, talking about what does he tell his son? I mean, what's your advice?
You know, Anthony, I'm struck by the emotion in some of these callers' voices when they
it's
relate
quite
their experience.
Powerful, yeah.
And even I'm getting a little kind of shook up, even though, you know, this is professional for me as well as personal because I'm a black man. And so, you know, I think it emphasizes that this is traumatic when it happens. You know, we talk about everyday racism, but people of color, we got to be survivors. And one of the survival skills, going to Anthony's question, is that, you know, black and Latino parents have the talk with their children, where you have to tell them the cops are not your friends. Some of them might be, but some of them are unfortunately out to get you. And so you keep your hands where their eyes can see, as the rap song goes.
Mm-hmm.
You say, sir, you don't assert too many rights. You do that later. But, you know, when folks of color interact with a police officer, what their goal is to get out of it without being killed, beaten up, or falsely arrested.
Mm. Rochelle Riley, you wrote, you know, we talked about this at the top of the hour, but you just talked, you wrote very eloquently in your piece about the sort of emotional weight of these events. And we're hearing that in a lot of these calls. And I'm just wondering what you've been hearing and how you've been responding to that.
Well, it is really hard to not be heartbroken when you hear a father talk about, you know, how to talk to his son about something like that happening, being pulled over, being harassed, being traumatized on a regular basis. That father is now facing what black fathers across the country have been dealing with for some time. And it's as wrong for them as it is for him. And there's got to be a way to stop all of it. I do think that there is a way to get to some of this without going overboard. For instance, the guys playing basketball and they call the police for a foul. If you call in a police officer or if you call into emergency to 911 and report a fight, and of course the officer gets there and there's no fight, that's a false report. You can't do that with everything, but there's got to be a way to nip some of that in the bud. But the bigger thing is just getting people to see that this is a problem. I'm still struck by the retired officer who called in to say that his chief had him look at some records, and he found that, I think he said almost 70% of the cases he found were instances of people of color calling the police on white people.
Right.
And he didn't say how many cases he found, but the idea that he found cases and that 30% of them were still what we're talking about, I don't think you can use that as an excuse to dismiss what's happening. This is a real problem.
Mm-hmm.
This is a real challenge for the country and for the people who are being harassed by it. And we didn't talk about this, and I don't want to make this a bigger deal right now than it has been, but I'm just so afraid that one of these times somebody's going to call the police and there'll be some overzealous officer who's dealing with some person who's angry at being targeted for doing absolutely nothing while black, and it could lead to an escalation that could be worse. We have to stop this before that happens.
Yeah. You know, Stephen Brown was talking about some long-term policy initiatives that might go a long way toward addressing social and racial segregation in this country. There's some short-term stuff that has happened in the wake of these things. And I want to ask you quickly, I'll come to you, Paul, about this. For instance, when the incident took place at Starbucks and the police were called because two black guys were in there waiting for a friend, and the cops showed up, handcuffed them, and took them away. Starbucks pretty quickly expressed regret about that, shut down the stores, gave everyone sensitivity training. Does that help? Was that enough for that particular incident? What's your thinking on that?
You know, it was a great start. The Starbucks incident, lots of good things came out of that, including we saw white folks stepping up. It's white folks who called out the police and said, not in our names. A white woman also took Peppermint Patty to task, the woman in Oakland who called the police on the family that was barbecuing. In my book, Chokehold, I talk about some relatively simple reforms that would make things marginally better. Changing the culture of policing, as President Obama recommended, to make cops less like warriors with a us-against-them mentality.
Yeah.
And more like guardians. So, real quick, more women cops, requiring cops to have college degrees, that would make a big difference.
All right.
Here.
And a lot more in your book. Paul Butler, professor of law at Georgetown University, author of Chokehold, Policing Black Men. Thanks so much for being with us today. I appreciate it.
Always a pleasure, Anthony.
And Rochelle Riley, columnist at the Detroit Press in Detroit, Michigan. Rochelle, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Steve Brown, research associate at the Urban Institute. Stephen, thank you for contributing to a great conversation. I'm very grateful.
Thank you, Anthony.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation, get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can also follow us on Twitter, find us on Facebook, and at On Point Radio. Thanks for listening today. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point. Mm-hmm.